State Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for August the 4th, 2019. Yes, the first Sunday in August. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, Lollapalooza, the last day of Lollapalooza. And here with a review of all of the bands is Dave Schwann.
I still am waiting to see the Strawberry Alarm Clock. And Tommy James and the Shondells.
You're going to be outside a long time.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, a few years ago, I went in and asked if the Electric Prunes were playing, and they told me to leave. So, just kidding.
The Electric Prunes sounds like a medical treatment.
There actually was a legitimate group in the late 60s. They had one big hit called I Had Too Much to Dream Last Night.
Wow. What year was that?
68 or 69.
Okay.
The same year Kenny Rogers had a hit called I Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In.
Oh, I know.
There was a lot going on back then.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. The times, wow, they're a-changing.
So I can't possibly name one band that's
there. I can't either.
I told someone yesterday, I had a wonderful afternoon and an evening yesterday, and I told her that all I'm really required to know is the information on closings and when this thing is going to end.
Exactly. What streets are closed,
yes,
and when, more importantly, when do they reopen?
Right, right, yeah. And the openings now plan on, really at the earliest, tomorrow evening.
Tomorrow
and we
evening.
Don't have a specific time as to when tomorrow evening, but, you know, as long as it takes for this to be set up, because they start setting up almost 2 weeks
right
before the festival, I would plan on these closures being in place through tomorrow evening, maybe even like early Tuesday morning. I'm hoping that they at least open Columbus Drive as a thoroughfare.
That would be helpful.
Yeah.
That would be helpful. Because I will trying to go down Michigan Avenue, going south on Michigan Avenue, can take half a day. I mean, it just seems that way.
Yeah.
It is really amazing how packed those Michigan, the north-south routes right there have just been State Street.
Yeah.
Even Dearborn, you know.
Right.
Dearborn and Clark.
Right. You also have congestion because of the fact that you cannot cut through Grant Park unless you're at Monroe Street. The earliest street there as you're headed south is Roosevelt, going toward Michigan, and that can be very congested from Lakeshore Drive, you know. Over
Roosevelt's always congested.
But especially so eastbound on Roosevelt from Lakeshore, because then you have the light at Indiana Avenue.
Oh, right.
And then Columbus first,
yes,
and then Indiana Avenue and Michigan Avenue, and then lights up close from Wabash to State until you get to the Roosevelt Road Bridge, which goes to Clark Street. That can be a mess.
It's always a mess.
You know, if you walk down to the sales department here in the building, you can not only see it, you can actually feel it and hear it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even think about
that. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because you can look right out on there and see it. You're right.
I mean, the base. I mean, I got done doing White Sox pregame yesterday and just walked to the other kitchen that we have here, and it happens to be down by the sales department, and it was loud. It was bassy.
Really? It was loud?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. And then I walked all the way to the end of the hall.
You mean these bands play loud?
It was loud enough for us to hear inside this glass encasement that we call a radio station.
Oh, this rock and roll, I don't know.
Yeah, I tell you, these kids.
These kids. Hey, you kids.
This rambunctious rock and roll.
But it was packed. I looked down the street. I guess that's Columbus I was looking down. It was packed.
Well, Friday, I was up at Channel 9, and the the camera from the helicopter with the, like at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, with like thousands of people still in line to get in through security. It just, it didn't look like a lot of fun. I'm sorry. What do I know?
But the weather was great for him this time around.
Oh, it's been beautiful.
Well, San Diego type weather.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
This has just been gorgeous.
They've been fortunate. If you remember several years ago, they had a giant thunderstorm that rolled through. And, you know, when these things happen, when there's thunder and lightning, the city requires the outdoor events to shut down, you know, for safety reasons. And everybody scattered very quickly to Michigan Avenue, standing along, you know, sidewalks there, especially next to buildings, to, you know, for whatever shelter they could have.
And you remember the mud that was caused, the damage.
Oh, yes. Caused. Yes, that lingered well into, the, you know, the end of summer and in September there.
Right.
Hutchinson Field was... not usable for a month or two after the festival.
Well, at least let's enjoy this weather. I mean, this is fantastic. This is definitely grilling weather.
Oh, yeah.
And I
what'd you have in mind, Rick?
I think some pork loin. Some pork loin chops on the grill today. I think that'll work.
Sounds good to me.
With last week with some pulled pork.
How'd that turn out?
It turned out actually very good. And my good friends down at 17th Street Barbecue in Murfreesboro, Illinois, Mike and Amy Mills, they have this new barbecue sauce, Apple City Red, and use that. And that's the new winner for me. I like their old traditional sauce.
Oh, it's great.
But Apple City Red. I
have you tried it yet?
Yeah, I used that on the pulled pork.
Oh, you used it on the pulled pork. Okay.
And, yeah, fantastic. And the trouble is now I'm going to have to hook up with those guys down at the State Fair in a couple of weeks and restock up.
You'll have to give us a full report.
On some sauce and on the magic dust.
And I want you to record the hog calling contest.
I'm not going to be there that day.
Oh, okay.
Let me quickly put that in. I am not going to be there.
You added that quite quickly.
Well, I'm going to hear enough windy rhetoric from Republican and Democrat,
Democrat days, yes.
Steve Scalise is the guest for Republican Day at the fair, and Nancy Pelosi is doing the breakfast.
Oh, is she?
Democrat.
Oh, okay.
The Democratic County Chairman's breakfast. So, yes, there'll be all kinds of rhetoric going on.
Yes, there will. So you don't need the hog calling or husband calling.
Or the largest boar.
The largest boar.
Yes.
B-O-R-E or B-O-A-R?
I will let you decide on that. It's one of those I do it so you don't have to kind of things.
And we appreciate that.
Yes, we do.
But hopefully it won't be the traditional 104 degrees with a humidity of 108% down in Springfield.
With 100,000 people in one place.
I don't know that they're going to draw that much this year. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how they do. I mean, they've got different kind of acts. It's kind of curious that Snoop Dogg is performing down at the fair.
Yeah.
Which, now that we've signed the law to legalize marijuana, I kind of wonder if you take that overhead trolley over the fairgrounds, if you just ride that back and forth, what kind of secondhand smoke you're going to get out of there. Could be very, very interesting. So
secondhand smoke.
Oh, man.
That's a good way of putting it.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, we got the Cubs are back in first place, at least by half a game.
Right?
But kind of interesting to see how they've done, the success that they're having against the Brewers after we played the Brewers last time, and the Brewers just manhandled the Cubs.
Well, remember where they play that game, those games.
Miller Park.
Yeah, and the Cubs have the worst road record in the National League.
I was looking at that today, because the Cubs have not lost 20 games at home.
No, and they have only won 21 away from home.
Yeah, they're 20 games over 500 at home, and they are 12 games under 500 on the road.
And that's a recipe for only a half game lead in a division.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we should be so much further ahead. It's frustrating. But I will tell you, the frustrating baseball news of the week was when the Cubs were playing down at Busch Stadium last week, and on the field was Illinois Secretary of State Jesse White unveiling the State of Illinois license plate with the Cardinals logo on it.
I saw that story. I think it broke on Thursday night.
It was the day he announced it was the day that the Cubs proceeded then to lose 8-0 and get one hit.
Yeah, that was Friday, I believe. And I had to read the story twice because I thought it was like a misprint that they said it was State of Illinois Secretary of State. Thought maybe it was Missouri.
Yeah, right. No, it is.
But, there is that line down there. I mean, I lived in Peoria for a long time. And there is a definite line through that city.
Oh, absolutely.
And it goes further down. You get by Gibson City, Coal City down that way, and it's all red. It's Cardinals down there, and it's kind of crazy.
Well, I mean, I did post a picture of the plate on Twitter. $25 of the license plate fee is supposed to go to the Common School Fund, which I added on Twitter that hopefully will be to educate children to be Cubs or Sox fans instead of Cardinal fans. But Jesse White is from grew up in Alton, which
right
I know Mr. Schwann knows very well down in the Metro East area.
Jesse White is from Alton?
Yes, yes. Well, that was the justification he gave.
I really didn't know that. I thought he was from around here.
No. So, Metro East is, diehard Cardinal fans over there.
Oh, yes. Yes, I really didn't discuss much Cubs-Cardinals activity with my uncle.
Well,
that lived there all his life.
Well, when I was at SIU Edwardsville, I was like the token Cubs fan. It had not exactly the SIU Edwardsville then was not what it is now, which is a major destination point for kids from the Chicago area.
When I saw the story a number of days ago in the Tribune about the State of Illinois making Cardinals license plates.
That's what we were just saying.
I was on the other side of the room when you were bringing that up, but those will be quite popular in that area.
I just can't. It's so hard.
You can't imagine it.
No. If there's one saving grace, it appears that while it has the Cards bird on the bat logo and it's got the Cardinal red, but the actual numbers on the plates, I do think are Cubby blue.
Okay, so that's a good trade-off, I would say.
Don't tell anybody, but that's the way that it appears to me. Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
Well, state needs money,
Got to get it any way you can, right?
Exactly. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has all of our latest sports. Producer Cassera is here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And we're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is reviewing his Lollapalooza playlist. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break on this beautiful Sunday morning. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Last week, round two of the two-night Democratic presidential debates based in Detroit. Interesting dynamic taking place on the first night with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren being paired together in the same group of 10. And rather than battle each other over who was more progressive, they seem to have formed almost a tag team to take on more moderate Democrats in their attacks. Now, here's Elizabeth Warren going after the Democratic moderates on health care.
We are the Democrats. We are not about trying to take away health care from anyone. We should stop using Republican talking points in order to talk with each other about how to best provide that health care. Democrats win when we figure out what is right and we get out there and fight for it.
Now, note that line she used about Republican talking points, and you're going to keep hearing that a lot to kind of shut down moderate dissent. From night two of the debate, Senator Kamala Harris going after Republican complaints about her ill-defined Medicare for All health care plan, going after moderate complaints about her plan.
We cannot keep with the Republican talking points on this. You got to stop. The reality is that under my Medicare for All plan, yes, employers are not going to be able to dictate the kind of health care that their employees get. They will be able to make that decision.
We'll have more from the debate as we go through this morning, and we'll also be talking to Jason DeSanto about his takeaways from round two of the Democratic debates. But right now, we're going to move things a bit more local. State Senator Mike Hastings, from Democrat from Tinley Park, is here. And, Senator, always a pleasure to have you in studio while you're enjoying the new digs here.
It's very nice. I mean, you get the best corner office in the entire building here, Rick. It's perfect for radio, as you say.
Well, you can see the stream on the computer if you want to see it. And but, yeah, and I have to admit, like, when it's now you have clouds here a little bit, which is, it's beautiful, but when there aren't any clouds, boy, that sun comes bursting in off the lake. It is it's quite the sight to see.
I noticed your tan. I was starting to wonder if you're outside
just,
a lot.
No, just hanging here out
just
in
the
studio.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, thanks, Senator, again for coming in. And, you know, perhaps it's probably timely that we talk about mental health, given kind of what we've witnessed on the national level this weekend with these mass shootings. And you're part of helping spearhead this effort for the Mira Neurobehavioral Health Center in Tinley Park. Tell me about, you've got hashtag, you know, March for Mental Health. And, yeah, and it, yeah. tell me about
so, probably about 8 years ago, we closed the Tinley Park Mental Health Center in the community. So when we closed the mental health center in Tinley Park, we dispersed our patient load onto local treatment providers in the area. And it was almost such an overload that our area couldn't handle the amount of patients that were coming out. And if you were to go to the hospitals, you would look at the emergency room and people would be sitting on gurney beds for 20 hours waiting to get treatment just because emergency rooms aren't necessarily capable of handling mental health issues. So we started this March to Mental Health, my initiative this year and this March, with various pieces of legislation. And for the past 6 years, I've been working with a doctor out of Palos Community Hospital. And all he wants to do is open a youth and adolescent mental health treatment facility. And I thought, what better of an opportunity for the South Suburbs to do that and to help our young people?
And, of course, with Tinley Park, the mental health center there was more kind of that deinstitutionalization effort that, you know, no one has problems with. But you're absolutely right. At the same time, you know, where do these people go for treatment?
In the South Suburbs, in the Southland, there was almost next to nothing. About a year ago, we opened Silver Oaks Hospital, a mental health treatment facility for all ages out in Will County. But in the Cook County area, there's really nothing for youth and adolescents. So if you look at the statistics, about 1 in 5 kids from ages 2 to 8 has some sort of diagnosable mental health disorder. About 1 in 7, I should say, for 2 to 8, and then 1 in 5 from 9 to 17. And about 15 to 25% of those populations seek mental health treatment. The rest do not. And I think part of the problems we're seeing in our country today, especially in Ohio, in Texas, I know for a fact Texas had a mental health, the shooter had a mental health issue. We're just not getting the treatment there that they need. Texas as a whole ranked 44th in mental health treatment in the entire country. I think you're starting to see some of the effects of not getting the help they need in those states. And I'm hoping in Illinois we can mitigate that.
Well, I mean, it seemed like mental health was an easy target on budget cutting. I mean, we saw it in the city of Chicago. And that coming against kind of a against the tide of the fact that people are understanding that mental health is on par with physical health issues.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I served on a school board in the South Suburbs, and you talk about drug issues and mental health issues. Those are probably the two biggest issues that we have in our youth today is, you know, using drugs, for that matter. And the drugs that are used are prescription medication, so ADHD medication. And then people have depression, anxiety at such a young age these days. There's really no safe space for somebody to go talk to somebody. And I think that's really important to have in the suburbs. And it really doesn't discriminate based on geographic boundaries, race, religion at all. And when you look at Will County versus Cook County in the suburbs, there's nothing in Cook County in the southwest suburbs that's an institution where somebody can stay for 5-7 days, get inpatient and outpatient treatment. And this MIRA, Neuropsychology Health Center, MIRA stands for Miracle. And it's just an awesome opportunity. And we're going to start outpatient services probably next fall time frame. And obviously, we have one more hurdle to clear.
I was going to say, have all the sign-offs come off here?
We have one more sign-off here from the Health Facility Service Review Board. But the interesting part about this license that the doctor had applied for is 44 other service providers in the area agreed. And these are people they're going to compete with in terms of services. We need more beds. We need to help more young people. Silver Oaks, which is probably the largest mental health treatment provider for young people, they're all for it. And that's a good sign that the community believes that this is necessary and that we're going to get people the help they need.
How many people, I mean, the mental health still has a stigma attached to it, and what do you think can be done to try and get the word out that you can seek treatment, that there is no stigma against going to seek help?
Yeah, the people you underestimate are people who you don't think get mental health treatment are getting mental health treatment. A lot of people are affected by this, especially my generation, those that are coming back from overseas. You see a lot of things over in Iraq and the borders of Iran, Syria, Afghanistan, where you have to go seek the help or else transitioning back to society is very difficult to do. And I can tell you that from a personal standpoint. It just has to be normalized to the point where if you need help, go seek the help you need. Nothing's wrong with it. And if you need medication to get you by, then that's okay, too. But it's just people need to feel more comfortable about it. And I don't think that's the case right now. But my march to mental health, I'm hoping that we're getting there. And we're setting an environment where people can feel more comfortable.
Well, you were talking about legislation that you were working on in Springfield.
We have Senate Bill 1715, which is an awesome piece of legislation. The governor, it's at the governor's desk right now. What it allows for is people to get long-term antipsychotic or mental health treatment in terms of injectables. So a physician could inject a long-term medication, Gludalee. I learned that Gludalee is the medical term. I used something else, which was frowned upon, but it's a bill that'll help get at least people 3 months stabilized. So if people are leaving the prison system and they have mental health treatment, you know, 3 months of stabilization will get them on the right track to focus on looking for a job, looking for a house, trying to get their life in order versus how am I going to get 3 months of prescription pills for my mental health treatment? And this also applies to the non-prison population as well. You can stabilize someone for a long term versus someone having to remember every week, hey, I got to take my medicine, I got to do this. And it'll allow pharmacists to do that. And Rick, just to access a care point, that's huge. And if somebody can get the help they need to prevent the problem later on the line, I think that's we should be doing more of that in the General Assembly.
Well, and, you know, obviously there's those issues of people not taking their medication, which this would seem to be something that would mitigate against that.
Not a doubt at all. And also these long-term injectables can help with anti-addiction problems as well, or addiction problems as well. Mm-hmm. So those that are addicted to opioids, and they have long-term injectables that can help prevent addiction problems, which also prevents long-term problems. I just think that if we invest more money now into the foundation of helping people where they need help, it's going to prevent long-term problems that do have an effect on our budget, whether that's the prison population, going Medicaid treatment for different services. I mean, it's a trickle-down effect that if we knock it out right now, we could prevent the cost later on down the line.
Well, once again, it's preventive medicine is really what it is. People think of it more in a physical aspect, but it's preventative mental health care medicine.
Yeah, I'm just grateful that, like, for me, I have great partners like Dr. Chris Higgins out of Palos Health. The guy is just a great guy. I mean, when you meet him, you just feel comfortable talking to him as it is. But the fact that him and his team want to invest money in rehabilitating a facility to make it an inpatient and outpatient treatment facility for young people is truly special. And the story that how he got that building, he bought the building from a service provider that used to help those with developmental disabilities. I mean, it's just a great story. You know, we're using our facilities that help people to help more people. I just think that's great.
Well, and you mentioned Mira as the name and miracle. And my understanding was it was a miracle to have this, to get to this point, and to get this structure and
yeah, it takes
and open it up.
It just takes a community. It takes people that believe in something, that you know, you identify the problem, you figure out a plan, and you go ahead and you execute that plan to get the mission done. And our community as a whole is just awesome when it comes to helping people. Tinley Park, Frankfurt, you know, Markham down to Matteson, it's just an awesome community where people are like, I can get behind this because our kids, if they need the help, we should get them the help. It doesn't matter where you're from or what your socioeconomic background is.
We're speaking with Democratic State Senator Mike Hastings from Tinley Park. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio with Michael Hastings, who's State Senator from Tinley Park. We're talking about the expected new mental health facility that's going to be there to help take care of adolescents and something, frankly, we need all over the place, not just in Illinois. And, you know, I'm wondering if there isn't some incentivizing that the state can't do for more of these treatment facilities.
I think the state as a whole, with the current budget that we just passed, is starting to invest back into our developmental disabilities, mental health treatment, which is huge. It's nice. And Rick, I've been on your radio show countless times, and I've had discussions about the previous governor, who we won't name today, but I'll just say that working with Governor Pritzker on a multitude of issues has been refreshing, and the investment that we've made into capital into the state, I mean, $43 billion, what that's doing to the South Suburbs, it's just never been done before in the South Suburbs, whether that's a new interchange to help the South Suburban Airport out, repaving and widening I-80 from Route 30 down the Ridge Road. I mean, it's a billion-dollar investment into I-80, and if you ever drive over that bridge out there in Joliet, they had the big warning billboard sign. That bridge is going to get repaved and repaired, which is probably replaced the way it's looking.
I think replaced, yeah.
It better get replaced. But if you look at just the investment into schools and opportunities for people in the suburbs, I mean, we got close to probably $1.5 billion, $2 billion out in the South Suburbs that it's really going to transform the landscape. So mental health services as a whole is definitely going to get an awesome bump by this. But I think overall, the South Suburbs and the entire state of Illinois, I mean, if you look at Route 47 from Woodstock, going up to Lake Geneva, if you go down south, the train tracks in Springfield are finally going to get moved from downtown to the I mean, these are things that this will never, in my view, this will never happen again, probably for 30 years, if that. I mean, you could probably tell me how long it was before you saw something like this package be put together. It's awesome.
It was probably during George Ryan's tenure. It was probably the last time. But, you know, we've talked a lot on this show, and you know, we see the complaints about the gas tax increase and that kind of thing, and you know, the argument being that the increase is actually, if you went by inflation, you know, if it had been indexed by inflation from the last time it was hiked, that's where it would be right now, and now in the future will be indexed by inflation, so it provides a much more sustainable way to deal with some of these capital problems. I mean, we are such a capital-intensive state, but at the same time, that's the marketing of this state.
Yeah. If you ask anyone in the South Suburbs, I'll just tell you the two biggest complaints are my property taxes are too high, and the roads, everywhere I go, the roads are falling apart. And driving around the city of Chicago, beautiful city, don't get me wrong, but you know, you could blow a flat at any given moment, depending on what road you're traveling down. Every mayor in the south suburbs is going to see double the amount of road repair money they would normally see from previous years. So that'll allow them to repave, resurface, redo, double the amount of roads in the south suburbs. And when it comes to property taxes, you know, establishing a property tax task force in Springfield to identify how do we alleviate some of the pressures and push different levers to make this thing work to the benefit of the south suburban residents. I'm really excited to see the outcomes of that. But the governor, the one thing I've seen the governor do this past year was invest in education. I mean, close to $300 million in additional education funding. And when we passed that funding reform bill a couple years ago, our schools really felt it in the South Suburbs in terms of this is a lot of money coming our way so we can educate our kids. But now we're going to see more. And that's important because we could take that money, invest in things like mental health and other things that help kids and get them involved. And that to me, that's what government should be doing, is helping our community. And I think we're really doing that.
Are you, the governor, signing this legislation to create the property tax relief task force? Now, we've had about seven of those.
Mm-hmm.
What makes you more optimistic that we're going to have something this time compared to what we've seen in the past?
A few things. First, I think the legislative body is just very motivated to get things done with the new governor. I've never seen a governor get as many things done in one session ever in my just from following it. And generally speaking, if we're going to go ahead and put all of our efforts into this, the time is now to do it. If you look at property taxes in Frankfort, Illinois, $17,000. Even if you go to Flossmoor, Illinois, same thing, $10,000 to $17,000. That's absurd. You know, if you look at Texas, there really isn't any property taxes. But again, that's why there isn't any services either. But 80%, 90% of our property tax bill in the suburbs goes towards education.
Right.
If we can help offset that cost that local schools have to levy on the taxpayers and spread it across the state, I think that's a very good thing, and it'll help alleviate the pain that we have in the suburbs.
Now, certainly the governor, when he campaigned, talked about, particularly talking about the graduated rate income tax, that, you know, revenues from that could help offset property taxes. But kind of in the layout of his master plan of the $3.5 billion that would be generated, there isn't really much there when it comes to property taxes. And people are saying, well, this task force can recommend ways and that would be implemented, you know, XYZ. I mean, to me, it's a massive fundamental shifting of funds, particularly for schools, to kind of achieve that what the Supreme Court called a goal. Mm-hmm. Is that the state should be the primary source of funding public schools in the state. I don't know that we'll ever get there. But, you know, certainly it will still take a significant amount of money to allow for a significant reduction in property taxes.
I think the fair tax is just one component of a overall solution towards lowering property taxes. Investing in education is definitely, from the state investing in education, that's another lever that pushes down the local area from having to levy those things. We also got to look at our governments in general. I mean, we have a lot of in my view, additional government bureaucracies.
The layers.
That we just don't need anymore. I mean, we're operating in a 1950s government operations when we should probably start modernizing how we do business. We looked at local government consolidation task force where we looked at townships, road districts. You know, there's a function for those governments downstate in southern Illinois. But, you know, there could be some efficiencies to be gained by maybe we should put on a referendum, let the voters decide whether or not we should maybe merge some of these things. I know I've voted on that and other legislators have voted on that, but you got to think outside the box. And if we're not doing that, something's wrong. I use Lincoln Way North High School as an example. It's a shuttered school. It was 8 years open. It's been closed for the last 4 to 5 years. What are we doing with the building? It's still on the debt. It's still on the property tax rolls for our community. Hey, let's start. So if the District 5 headquarters in Will County is condemned, why don't we move Illinois State Police District 5 headquarters to the school? If we're going to sell the Thompson Center down in the downtown area, why don't we start moving some of those agencies down south and start consolidating in brand new buildings with state of the art, just like your facility here, Rick? Morale goes up, efficiencies go up, brings jobs to the area. You got to think outside the box, because if not, things are just going to stay the same.
Well, and this is the time to do it.
And we have the capital bill to help invest. You look at the forensics lab, which is, I think, was built in 1968. Down in our area, Lincoln Way North High School has enough land not only to facilitate the state police headquarters, public health, IEMA, a lot of other agencies. We could build the forensics lab right there. Interstate access. You got corridors there in terms of towns, talent access. We got a major university in Governor State University there. Our area is prime for building, and now's the time to do it, as you said.
And that sounds like a commercial for J.B. Pritzker's ears.
Well, Governor, I hope you're listening to the appreciated $55 million investment in a forensics lab in the suburbs. But
how strange for a state senator to be advocating for his district.
I just know this. Working with the governor, working with the staff, working with the legislative body and the senators in the Senate, it's been nothing but a pleasure and an honor to do that, Rick. And we got a lot of great people down there, regardless of what people say about politicians being crooks and so on and so forth. There's some genuinely awesome people down there that are trying to do the right thing.
Democratic State Senator Mike Hastings from Tinley Park, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, thanks again. It's good to see you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Obviously, again, we had the debates, second round two of the two-night debates in Detroit last week. And interesting on the second night, because you kind of had this questioning over Joe Biden, questioning of the Obama administration, what they did when Biden was vice president. And among those who was taking on the former vice president was New York, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, accusing the former vice president of trying to have it both ways when it came to Barack Obama.
Mr. Vice President, you can't have it both ways. You invoke President Obama more than anybody in this campaign. You can't do it when it's convenient and then dodge it when it's not. And the second thing, and this really irks me because I heard the vice president say that, if you got a PhD, you can come right into this country. Well, that's playing into what the Republicans want, to pit some immigrants against other immigrants. Some are from countries, and some are from worthy countries.
And also on night two, California Senator Kamala Harris had a rough night in that second day debate. Hawaii Senator Tulsi Gabbard went after Harris's record as a prosecutor in California.
I want to bring the conversation back to the broken criminal justice system that is disproportionately negatively impacting black and brown people all across this country today. Now, Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. There are too many examples to cite, but she put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana.
So we see the firing squad in a circle that Democratic politics can often be. We'll be talking about that up ahead later in the show with Jason DeSanto from Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. But right now, joining me in the Allstate Skyline studio is John Chase, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, and BGA investigator Alejandra Cancino. They had this great piece. Alejandra, it was an outstanding piece. And you needed to have it in a magazine. It was in Chicago Magazine because it was so comprehensive. But basically, the way I've been seeing it is all of the billions of dollars over the years that have been pumped into O'Hare International Airport with great extravagant promises, what do we have to show for it?
And that's the great question. So we went back into the archives, and what we found was a long history of corruption.
Shocking, right?
More than a dozen people have gone to jail following federal or local investigations that started at O'Hare or were directly related to O'Hare. And what we thought was really interesting is that the history is striking when you consider how much we've spent to redo what's already been done. And the promises being made now echo some of those promises being made before.
I mean, there's so many facets to this story, but one of the things I look at the saga of the international terminal at O'Hare, and how, you know, here went, you know, decades ago, state of the art, boom, 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 all of this stuff is bragged about as all being state of the art. Now we're going to build a new one.
I'm glad you picked up on that. So that was one of our examples that we focus on, because so the idea was to pick three examples that were, you know, at the time some of the biggest public construction projects in the history of the city. And one of them was the International Terminal. And like you said, I mean, we're going now build what will be the fourth International Terminal when it's finalized. And we're talking about the new Global Terminal that Mayor Rahm Emanuel unveiled last year. And it's part of this multi-billion, it's $8.5 billion project to modernize the airport yet again. And yeah, I mean, time and time again, the first international terminal was built in the 1960s. It was finished in 1963, actually. And it opened to reviews of it being already crowded. And
right. It was already, as a new facility, it was already had been defeated and it already crowded. And this is before the TSA. You know, this is not just, you know, we didn't have any security then. It was just that's the customs checkpoints were already being overwhelmed.
Right, the long lines at customs. And so that's why we later moved into a parking lot, which was supposed to be a temporary facility. And we ended up being there for 8 years.
Which cost how much for the...
It was millions, again, to do
as a temporary facility.
As a temporary facility. And then we ended up with what's now Terminal 5, which ended up costing more than $600 million. And that's about double what was originally budgeted for.
And now we move ahead to back to Terminal 2.
Right.
I guess will be the old Terminal 5. They'll move it back to the middle of the concourse.
The main terminal, right. Now, the new global terminal will be this idea of having, part of it is because the way the airlines run their business, right? They want to have this, here is a hub where you have multiple flights coming in, and they want to have connecting flights. So if you're traveling
seamless travel.
Seamless travel, right.
Is, I think, the marketing term for
that
it.
That is the marketing term.
But here again, I mean, let's look at the new, this new terminal. Who picked it? Who made the decision of all of the different firms that were vying for it?
Well, we don't know, because it was
$8.5 billion.
Well, I mean, Rahm Emanuel's administration, as you know, Rick. I mean, they laid this whole thing out, and then it is sort of it was laid on the lap of Mayor Lightfoot now, and now it's moving forward. And they're picking Jeannie Gang. They picked it to sort of oversee. She's a Chicago architect. And Blair Kamen with the Tribune was very critical of this process because it was behind closed doors. You can't get all the materials of what went into who is bidding for what. So we're starting to see some of the same things that Alejandra found in her investigation repeating itself, at least initially, on this project. And so that was one of the big reasons we wanted to do this project at this time, is because of that, is because, you know, we're about to enter what very well may be the biggest public works project up to now in Chicago's history. And people need to know about the transparency of it and need to know what's going behind the scenes. And already we're starting to see that maybe that's not going to happen.
Well, and Blair raised some valid criticisms, mm-hmm. too, not Absolutely. Just of the process, but of the, you know, what the actual design was, which I realize that goes beyond the scope of what you're looking at. But frankly, it reminded me of what you were talking about from the very first international terminal, that, you know, it's got to be functional. And you know, obviously everybody's trying to peddle something, and seamless transport, you know.
Right.
You know, and to me it looks like, you know, a lot of questions need to be raised about the number of levels and, you know, the access issues
for folks. And yeah, and I mean, every time you go through these projects, you know, they're designed to be up to date for when
state of the art
when they're going to be done, and inevitably they always seem to be, you know, already behind the times by the time they, you know, they cut the ribbon. And again, that's one of these frustrations that I think travelers have. I mean, just in the last few weeks, that there's been problem after problem at O'Hare, you know, just related to what should be, you know, everyday nuisances, but not major problems.
Well, remember the reconfiguration of the runways was supposed to take care of all the weather-related issues.
And that still hasn't been resolved. That was one of the other points we brought up. That was Mayor Daley, you know, and that landed in Rahm's lap. And he didn't, you know, finish that project. And yeah, so the modernization program, I think they announced that in 2001. And of course, there's
Boy, do I feel old.
Yeah, I know, me too.
We're speaking to John Chase, Director of Investigations at the Better Government Association, and PGA investigator Alejandro Cancino about her research into kind of the history of the billions of dollars that we poured into O'Hare. And the money keeps flying away. We'll be back with more right after this. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined by two of my former Tribune colleagues who have moved on to the Better Government Association, Alejandro Cancino, who's a BGA investigator who's written this great package that appeared in Chicago Magazine. You can also read it at the BGA,
BetterGov.org,
which kind of just a litany of the millions and billions of dollars that have been pumped into O'Hare International Airport, and what do we have to show for it? John Chase is also with us. He's Director of Investigations for the BGA. And Alejandro, I wanted to move. We talked about the international terminal. How about this people mover? What the heck's going on with this?
And that was some of the things. What we wanted to do here was to show readers some of the promises that have been made and what came of those promises, right? And so when we looked at the people mover, what I thought was really interesting was this idea of history repeating itself. So when the people mover opened in 1993, it was years behind schedule and millions of dollars over budget. And now fast forward to today, the people mover is now being updated and it's again a year behind schedule. It's actually shut down now, so no one can take the people mover. It's expected to open in September, although we don't know whether that deadline will be met. And it's, again, more than $23 million over budget. And so you have this bright history repeating itself again and again.
Well, and what I found fascinating in your article and the research was nobody was really a fan of this thing to begin with.
That's right. The airlines.
It was like, well, this is something that they do at airports, so we should have one too. Right. And now, and we're talking about, okay, so we're talking about $334 million is the upgrade here. Whereas this is for 2.2 miles. 2.2 miles.
Right. It's nearly 3 miles.
Because there'll be an extension to it. Because it'll finally go to the rental cars.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Right.
Which they didn't do when they initially built it, because why would we do that?
Right.
Who wants to? So
you still had to take a shuttle.
So I mean, you still take a shuttle bus to go get the rental car.
Right.
So, yes, because this was all done to modernize and alleviate the road surface transportation in the airport.
Yes.
So let's have this rail system.
Right. So, because the idea at the time, so the city was thinking about the fact that the airport is so big, so they were talking about how they didn't want, you know, people were complaining about how long they had to walk, and so they decided that this people mover was something that they could use to really move
people around. And it has happened. It is used at other, that system is used at other airports.
It is. Almost every airport has a people mover. So
much more efficiently, I might add. Even at hated airports like DFW and Atlanta, it's at least efficient.
That's one of the things. It's, you know, the ideas may or may not be good. Like, we're not here saying we're experts on, like, yeah, this is how it should have been done or not. But the execution time and again has been lacking for generations. From the international terminal to the runways to the people mover, what you don't see is the execution on time. Under budget or on budget, everything's over budget. All three of those examples have been either over budget or late or both. And that's one of the problems that we, as citizens, we probably don't want to see repeat with this $8.5 billion package.
Is it just because the piggy bank is kind of unlimited?
Well, I mean, the city has a lot of reasons as to why things didn't go as planned, right? With, you know, the people mover, they will say, well, you know, there were things that were unexpected, right? They, with the runways, they talked about, you know, one of the examples that the Jamie Reed, who's the current commissioner of aviation, gave me was when you do a repair in your house, you initially budget for one amount, and then they open the walls, and then they find mold behind the walls, and then they have to do a lot more.
How many moldy runways do we have?
Well, that was something that, you know, I pressure her on. It's like, okay, well, but we're talking about the city has consultants, right? There's
well, this is shouldn't this be part of the pre-planning phase that
yes, you usually build a contingency. Yes,
I mean
for your housing project. And to your point about the piggy bank, what I'd like to add is, I mean, so what you hear over and over again is this isn't taxpayer money technically because it's fees and it's on the travelers who go through O'Hare, and that's often used as a
that's what I meant protection. About the a piggy bank
exactly
here.
Yes, that's this protection between oh well we're not wasting your money we're wasting all the schmucks
who have to go through O'Hare, which includes us.
How many times have we used O'Hare or Midway
right?
And it's borrowing, and there is I don't want to say it's not limitless, but it's a lot of borrowing, and it enables governments on these projects and others to, you know, to be a bit of a piggy bank. And that's one of the other things that Alejandra found was this trough of the same folks, contractors, lobbyists, coming back to the same to O'Hare for this work to often redo the work that they did, you know, 10, 15 years earlier.
Yeah, and I think that's a big factor, too. And that's what I meant about, too, with the piggy bank is you've got these interests that are they're specialized, you know, in some respects, but they know that they can keep going back to the well for more.
And to that point, I mean, it is the taxpayer money. I mean, when you think about the fact every worker that works at the airport has to park at the airport. When you park at the airport, you pay an extra fee that goes into that bucket of money for construction. Every time you buy a plane ticket, you pay an extra fee that goes into that bucket of money for construction. Every time you buy anything at the airport, there's a revenue sharing agreement with the city that goes into that bucket. So we use that airport, and the money belongs to the taxpayer.
Well, we touched on runways earlier, but the fact that, you know, that here you have, let's see, so we have who's pouring the concrete?
Well, some of the same. You got Walsh Construction. You got some of the long time construction companies that have been doing that this work, and then
including companies that have run afoul offshoots. Yes. I should say offshoots of companies had run afoul of the law.
One of the things we found was there's a current company called K5, which years earlier, and they're still getting business out at O'Hare. Their father, grandfather, had gotten in trouble and essentially was for work at O'Hare, and then they had changed their name and done some corporate paperwork, and they're still out there, still doing work.
Yeah, I mean, this is going back to 1970s, right?
Yes.
So in the 1970s, there was...
I remember those, by the way.
The 1970s. Right, and so there was, a huge investigation that started with big rigging at the airport over runway contracts, and ended up being a huge federal investigation into big rigging in contracts for the Stephenson Highway. But it all started out of here, which we thought was really interesting, and some of those companies that were involved in that are still at the airport today.
We talked about bonding. I mean, certainly the same kind of bond firms are you know, making big buck on everything that's being bonded out there.
Yeah. And I think about those as in buckets, because it's a good way for me to remember this, is that everyone, there's like buckets of money to be made at the airport, right? And so one bucket is, like you said, is, you know, the law firm and financial firms that get money from bond deals. And so just during the Manuel's administration, they received, they split $62 million worth of fees just for issuing bonds. The other bucket is lobbying, and since 2012, lobbyists have made $31 million with from firms with an interest at the airport.
That's $100 million right there.
That's just right. That's just in fees. That's not an actual work.
Right. There's nothing. Yes.
You haven't laid down 1 inch of concrete or
taken a ride on a people mover.
Right. Or put one screw into the wall.
I'd encourage everybody to take a look at this this piece. It's really some great work. And Alejandra Cancino, BGA investigator, thank you so much. John Chase, director of investigations at the BGA, thank you both for
being
here.
Thanks for having us.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me in studio is Jason DeSanto. He's a senior lecturer at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, specializing in, the polite term would be maybe you're a specialist in political rhetoric?
Yeah, political rhetoric, public advocacy.
I mean, rhetoric being the polite term.
That's more than polite. That's Sunday morning polite.
Yeah, that's, that's so we don't lose our license here at the radio station.
Is that the bar we're trying to jump over?
Do not make me seek out the panic button, okay? Please, okay. Please. Jason, thank you for joining me. I wanted to start our discussion of the round two tonight debate in Detroit of the Democratic candidates. I wanted to start that by playing what I thought were two of the more significant jousts that were raised there. So I guess one of the best smackdowns was from Elizabeth Warren to former Congressman John Delaney. Delaney, who seemed to get an inordinate amount of airtime only because he was an instigator, I think. Delaney complained that the progressives were making promises that they couldn't fill.
So I think Democrats win when we run on real solutions, not impossible promises. When we run on things that are workable, not fairy tale economics.
Senator Warren?
Do it.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
So there was that smackdown. And then for his part, I thought Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders offered a pithy response when Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan questioned Sanders' provision that private health insurance would go away under Sanders' Medicare for All plan.
This plan that's being offered by Senator Warren and Senator Sanders will tell those union members who gave away wages in order to get good health care, that they're going to lose their health care because Washington's going to come in and tell them they got a better plan.
Two things. They will be better because Medicare for All is comprehensive. It covers all health care needs for senior citizens. It will finally include dental care, hearing aids, and eyeglasses.
But you don't know.
Second of all.
You don't know that,
second
Bernie.
Of all.
We'll come to you in a second,
I do know, and I wrote the damn bill.
I wrote the damn bill.
That's Bernie in a nutshell.
Yes, right it there. Is. I wrote the damn bill. I remember someone, I think it was Hickenlooper talking about being a mayor and Bernie. I was a mayor, too.
Remember in 2015, on the eve of the 2016 election, when he and Hillary Clinton were going at it, and he announced, I'm sick of hearing about your damn emails.
That's right.
Via Brooklyn.
That's right. So, obviously the dynamic of the progressive versus moderate, which I never thought of moderate as a term you would use to talk about Democratic candidates.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think I'd ever written the term, a moderate Democrat before. I mean, it was the old days, it was moderate Republicans, you would talk about as moderates. But truly, there is this differentiation in the Democratic Party.
Well, because it's a party that actually features some differences in thought. Okay, not to be too reductive about it. This is a debate that they're going to be having all the way through the fall and into the early part of next year. But you're right, Rick. I mean, these are different gradations of how do we do better than Obamacare, which suddenly has become not only the ground floor of what health care should be, but in some ways the candidates are arguing about the next iteration of health care reform without really talking about what Obamacare does well, did well. It's sort of right on to what the solution is. And to me, as part of a policy debate, that's a little bit of the problem, mm-hmm. because they're not really engaging on exactly which problems they want to solve for whom. Some of them are talking about covering the uninsured, which was a major part of the Obamacare debate. Some of them implicitly, I think, are focusing on the degree to which healthcare costs too much. I have not heard really one good answer from one candidate about these are the two or three problems we need to solve. Obamacare got us to here. Here's what's not working about that, and here's how we do better. Yeah, instead, we're all sort of engaging on how does this simply look great?
Or into hyperspace about Medicare for all, and that will take care of every problem, again, without identifying the problem. I thought one of the interesting things was, here again, kind of this, as I referred to it earlier, is the Democrats in a circle kind of thing. But it was not bringing up the thing that Republicans have been facing, which is pre-existing conditions, and not going after Republicans on that issue.
It's come up as a counter in some of the arguments, but it's never the lead argument.
It's never projected.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to the point I was making a minute ago. The 2018 midterms were largely won in a lot of swing districts in the House of Representatives races because of the issue of pre-existing conditions. That would be something I would want to identify right away in terms of laying out what the problem is, then talk about the number of uninsured, then talk about maybe the cost of prescription drugs. But I'd be very clear about those things and then talk about how this plan gets us a little further along the way. Otherwise, I think it's contextually a little difficult for people who are not, for example, in the Twitterverse to kind of figure out.
Which is most people.
Well, and here's the point to me, Rick, is that some people would say, well, Medicare for all sounds very radical and it's going to be cast as very radical. Well, maybe not. I mean, maybe we're at a point with the healthcare system where it isn't. I think there are people who are willing to listen to common sense arguments about what should come next if they understand what it is that you are trying to actually solve and whether that particular problem resonates with them. And until you do that, you're missing opportunities to actually move people who might otherwise come to your side.
Well, that's why I think it's interesting in the issue of like private insurance, and not that anybody's a big fan of insurance companies or that kind of thing. But, you know, there are those who like the insurance that they have. The question not being asked is, for your private insurance, how much have your premiums increased over the years? And what could you get in a, quote, Medicare for all system that would provide essentially equivalent coverage and net out the cost of whatever the increased taxes would be for that coverage?
Yes.
Am I being too common sense here?
No, I think that's true. And maybe someone could make the point that if we didn't have 10 candidates on stage, maybe it would be more likely to get into that kind of a discussion. But I think the other piece of it, Rick, is not only the cost, but also I don't think people necessarily love their insurance companies. I mean, they like when their deductible doesn't bankrupt them.
Right.
But they like their doctors. They like the medical care they get. I mean, to me, the argument about private insurance is partially about payment, but it's also a proxy for, I don't want to get thrown into a program where I'm going to have to wait longer for an appointment to see somebody I don't want to see. Now there, of course, now there's an impediment, I think, for Democrats who are making the argument for Medicare for all, because they run right into Obama's promise that if you like your doctor,
I was just going to say, right? That's the famous line.
Right. So now rhetorically, that's the next hurdle that somebody has to get over. But to me, this all starts with first and foremost pointing people to what doesn't work. And that begins to focus listeners on, okay, now how do we make it better?
I mean, because we're not really at least I'm not hearing it is, you know, let's fix it. Which used to be, you know, even among supporters, those in Congress, the Democrats that voted for it, was, yeah, we know it's not the end all, and we'll just keep fixing it. But I'm not hearing, I mean, fix maybe sounds not progressive enough.
Well, there is a point regarding the argumentation there, which is that Warren clip you played, the first one, the one with John Delaney, is a prime example of these healthcare debates become policy debates. The first night of the debates were largely about the big questions, the macro question. Are we going to have private health insurance preserved or not? The second night of debates was about more of the micro, which is here's what's in my plan versus your plan. But to my ear, they're not just debating about health care. They're actually debating about a view of the world and about whether you are somebody who's for bold action or not for bold action. Warren's response to Delaney, why do you bother to run unless you're willing to do something,
big things,
is really a way to take the healthcare argument and make it a vehicle for a much larger argument about the nature of the candidate. I'm bold, you're not. And in that way, the policy arguments begins to fade away a little bit and becomes much more about the trust level we have with the candidate. I don't think that's inappropriate. I think candidates do that all the time quite properly. But that is a way in which, again, we move a little bit further away from the nature of the problem we're trying to solve and a little bit more towards either what our solutions are or who the candidate
is. Or character definition.
Yeah, character definition, right.
I mean, and in fact, I thought it was interesting, too, with Kamala Harris kind of got lost in the weeds of her own plan at one point.
So we were here a few weeks ago talking about the first debate.
Right.
And in that debate, she was masterful. I thought this week she was miserable. She got lost in the details of her own plan. She looked exasperated constantly. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, you have to know that if you're rising, you're going to be the one that's going to be the center of attacks. And so the more prepared you are for those attacks, those become opportunities, every one of them. And we saw a number of candidates who actually did well by being attacked. As wobbly as he was, I thought Biden reinforced himself in his position a little bit by being relatively competent in handling attacks. I thought other people like Julian Castro, Cory Booker, were attacked. Castro on what his position on immigration was when he was in the Obama candidate cabinet. Booker on his record as mayor of Newark. They were both prepared, and they both handled those well. And as a result, they looked stronger. They were more likable. Harris didn't do that. I mean, she really looked peeved most of the evening. And that's just not the demeanor you want, and the substance of the answer, as you alluded to, at least on healthcare, was not particularly strong. She never did really counter any of the arguments about her record on criminal justice.
Not at all.
Which has been a subject for months and months and months and months.
And
you have to know that's coming.
You just took the words right out of my mouth. Is that has been a demonstrated case of baggage for her candidacy. You know what's going to come out of it. You know what your record is. What is your defense?
Well, her response was, I was in there and I did the work. I think the argument is it's much harder when you're actually in a leadership position. The rest of you are throwing stones. I was actually in the middle of it. But the problem with that is she never really confronted any of the individual claims that were made by Biden or by Tulsi Gabbard about her record. And I think when you don't pick out at least one point that somebody
you can
else
rebut.
Made, that you can rebut and then pivot to some higher ground or to some other point, it begins to look a little slippery. And you know, one of the criticisms of her candidacy is that it's essentially about nothing. It doesn't have a core message. And if that's the overriding narrative about your campaign, anything you do that begins to play into that, whether by commission or omission, really works against your overall campaign. And it certainly works against your performance for one evening. And I thought that's what happened to her the other night.
She just didn't look comfortable.
No.
I didn't see any. And who knows? Maybe it was Joe Biden walking out and saying, you know, take it easy on me, kid.
I highly doubt that is what did it. And the other thing, too, she had a kind of a dormant campaign for a long time and then did really well in that first debate. So it could just as well be that she has a bad debate and then comes back really well in September. These things go up, they go down, there are actions, there are reactions. So we shouldn't read too much into it. But if you're asking me empirically how it looked and how she did, that was not a good performance.
We're speaking with Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer of the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. We're talking about some of the takeaways from round two of the two-night Democratic debate. Too damn long.
It was a long night.
Two nights.
Two long nights. I thought once you got into the 9:30 component of the 7 to 10, I was fooled actually, because I thought they were finishing.
We were just talking about this off air. We were figuring this will be nice because it's on an hour earlier than usual. So it'll be 7 to 9, and then it'll be done. Except then it came to 9 o'clock, and they're still going. And then it came to 9:30, and they were still going.
Yeah, and nobody needs to see Bill de Blasio in hour three. So a little goes a long way, I think, is the watchword there.
Do you think we're now at the point of these two rounds of debates where maybe not certainly not voter attitudes have set in, but certainly among funding sources have set in, that some of these candidates are going to find out that there's nobody to punch their ticket, and we start seeing some folks drop out?
So you have a combination of two things that are going on. One is the requirements to get on the debate stage in September are higher.
Right.
So for the first
more
debates,
individual donors and a higher polling showing than 1%.
Yep. We move from 65,000 donors to 130,000 donors. We move from 1% in the polls to 2% in the polls. And rather than an either or between donors and polling position, it's both. So this is a much higher threshold. And so I think at this point, about 10 candidates have or shortly will pass those thresholds. So that will cut the number down. And then in turn, when that happens, that'll be in September. If they're not on the debate stage in September, what's going to happen is they're going to lose visibility. And so when you have a fundraising deadline for the quarter at the end of September,
right,
some people just are not going to be able to push over that line what they need to, and that will be the point at which some of them are going to turn out the lights.
What about this month, though? Does anybody get out this month?
Maybe.
I mean,
but I don't.
I still think it's too early.
Yeah, and I don't know until you get to that fundraising deadline or the next debate deadline, which is August 28th, to get into the September debates. I don't know whether there's a real need to do that. So if you're asking me about August, I'd suspect probably not. If you're asking me about September, yes. If you're asking me about October, definitely.
Well, August, it's state fair time in Iowa. So, you know, everybody's got to go visit the stage in Des Moines and get whatever volume you can out of it.
Yes, yes. Watch for my book on that time of year. It's called A Time for Funnel Cakes. And it's all about
all kinds of
time.
All kinds of deep fried recipes.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Well, then you should join me in Springfield in a couple of weeks.
I'm going to let you go, and then I'm going to look for your reviews.
No, you don't want to see my review. I'm not a big State Fair fan.
That's unfortunate.
Well, I'm not going to get into it.
Okay.
I appreciate those that love the State Fair.
Yeah.
And for those who like a really good State Fair, I would send them to Wisconsin instead of the Illinois State Fair, which may sound unpatriotic, but it's a better State Fair in Wisconsin.
How about DuQuoin? That is a lovely State Fair.
That is a throwback State Fair, actually.
Yeah.
And obviously no Confederate Railroad will be performing there. You know what I'm referring to.
Yeah, I do.
That they were supposed to play.
Yeah.
And then
they're not playing there
either.
They
got canceled,
yes,
by the state. And now a local Harley dealer apparently is having them perform.
Okay.
So, but we digress.
Okay, yes.
Mayor Pete.
Yes.
Speaks of substance. Is he making enough of a breakthrough?
He's maintaining his position. He's reinforcing himself with people who already like him. But yeah, there's room for him to continue to improve his performances and also ascend in the polls as well. And I think my argument there would be he will do better when the field winnows a little bit. And the contrasts he can draw are a little bit more dramatic in terms of the generational arguments and also some of the more hard-edged arguments. To me, as a debater, you're right. I think he makes relatively substantive arguments. I think his talent is in being able to speak a language of values and common sense and reframing of issues in ways that Democrats often don't. He gave an answer in a debate a couple of weeks ago about education. And he said one of the things we have to do is we have to make sure that it is just as viable for people not to go to college as to go to college and then be able to contribute to their communities and Little League and their churches. There's just a comfort level there at being able to use those indicators of Midwestern small town life. He comes by it honestly, having been a mayor. And that is always impressive. I think he was reaching a little bit in some of his performance this past week. And there are two examples. One, his answer on race is still, in contrast to the kind of answer I just described, highly mechanical.
Right.
And very much, I have to hit two or three
calculated
talking points.
Mm-hmm.
It's not natural. He still, I can tell in watching him, looks like he is on unsteady ground there. Secondly, he was trying to draw a contrast with his military service and Trump. I could tell in watching it that that was a goal because he took a question about climate change and pivoted it all the way to, it doesn't matter what our positions are on climate change unless we can beat Trump. Let me tell you how I'm going to beat Trump, and I'm going to beat Trump by being on the stage next to somebody who shirked military service while I served in the military. Now, that's a good way of contrasting yourself, but it's a long way from the question on climate change. That seemed forced.
Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer, Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Thank you so much for joining me, and hope to have you again in September.
Thanks, Rick.
For the next debate.
Yep, I look forward to it.
I got you signed up right now.
It just happened.
Thank you so much.
All right, man.